Hello, hello everyone! Welcome to the fifth episode of Paleo Party Season 2, sponsored by the Paleontological Society. As always, I am joined by the wonderful Emma and Chris, and everyone here in the Twitch chat. And as a minor announcement, apparently football is coming home, and England are trying not to lose to Denmark in the Euros. So if you hear any loud cheering, or perhaps even sobbing, from the pub down the road, we apologise in advance. We have a very special guest this evening who's going to be talking to our skeleton crew. She's a paleontologist with a bone to pick with us. It's Yara Haraday, everyone! Woo!
Asking our guests to attempt to explain what they do using the Opcore 5 text editor, which only allows them to use 1,000 most commonly used words in English. And I believe Yara's had some trouble with this today because it doesn't allow her to use the word bone. So what have you come up with?
Can you believe that bone is not one of the 1,000 most commonly used words? It's actually pretty ridiculous.
Shocking. Frankly shocking.
Not much, right? Okay, so this is what I've come up with. Yara Haraday, that's me, studies the inside of very old animals to understand how today's animals work. I look at the spaces that cells leave behind inside very old rocks that have very old animal remains. The old remains of these animals are now not made of animal stuff, but rather of rock stuff. And they can still tell us a whole lot. Which I actually think is probably better than my thesis presentation is going to be.
It's pretty good.
First of all, cells. Cells is one of the more commonly used words, but bone isn't.
Well, cells cells has different contexts, right? Because it could be like prison cells.
That's dark.
Sorry. I don't make the rules.
Like prison cells, it's fine.
Yeah,
it's
fine. as opposed to prison bones.
Yeah. Well, that was a fantastic introduction, and I want to remind everyone that we're live on Twitch. So please send in your questions and your comments for Yara, either on the Twitch chat or to our Twitter handle, which is @PaleoParty, spelt the British way with two A's in the first word. Let's kind of delve into some of your research and give you a few more words to play with. Do you want to describe what you do with more than the 1,000 most commonly used words?
Sure, but only a few more. So basically what I do, or what I currently do, is I'm studying bone evolution. So basically how our skeleton turned out to be the way it is and why it turned out to be the way it is. And why it didn't turn out to be made of glass or tooth stuff or anything like that. So when I say glass, people are like, oh, that's crazy. Actually, like a bunch of animals basically use silica for skeletons, you know, sponges and such. So why do our skeletons look the way they do? Why do they heal the way they do? Why are they shaped the way they do? Why do they react the way they do? Because we take a lot of what exists now kind of for granted. One of the reasons that I love paleo so much is because you get to ask these big questions of the thing that's here today, how did it get to be here? And was it always like this? And you get to ask these massive questions and actually look for answers. So one of the questions I'm asking is, yeah, why do our bones act the way they do? And so I get to look at really, really old fish and really, really old tetrapods, the four-limbed animals, and check out what they did with their bone and compare it to modern things and see, okay, yeah, pretty much the same. So that's a really old feature. Or, whoa, that's really different. They are doing something completely different. So where did that feature actually show up and why? So that's kind of the umbrella of what I'm doing now. But for everyone that's listening at home and wants to ask me about something else, my master's was on teeth. So all the weird things in your mouth, yeah, those things. How did those come to be? What did they do? How did they evolve? How did they replace? Because unlike us, which only get two sets, most animals get a bunch of sets. So I studied that for my master's, and most of my side projects include pathology, so diseases in the fossil record, particularly paleopathology. So if you want to ask me about diseases in the fossil record, or teeth, or bones, or what it's like to be a graduate student, or any of that, send your questions as we chat.
Perfect.
You're basically doing my job for me as well by asking people that question. I'm just going to leave. I'll see you later. Bye.
Your paycheck, if that's your paycheck.
Yeah. I wish we got paid. What?
I'm going to jump straight in. So you mentioned glass.
It's an Emma Dunn segue already.
Oh, Emma Dunn special. You mentioned glass. One of my favorite animals ever is actually made. It's one of the glass sponges, and it's the Venus flower basket. And I absolutely love that there's shrimp that grow up inside it and that they fall in love together.
Wait, what? What?
Yeah.
What?
So the Venus flower basket sponge is a sponge that looks like a white basket in a kind of a typical cube-like sponge shape.
Where are they
and
from?
There are these. Ooh, I don't know.
No, I shouldn't have flummoxed you. So sorry.
Oh, no. Sorry. I believe they're from the Pacific. So okay. Around that area. Nowhere near where we are at the moment. They're particularly popular as wedding gifts in parts of Asia, I believe, because of the love story of the shrimp that enter these sponges and then get too big to leave. And they stay there with their partners. It's so cute. It's a little bit dark, but it's really cute.
Wait, do they die?
No, but it is.
I assume so.
It's a little bit of Stockholm syndrome. It's like, you know, stuck in a cell together.
A prison cell, you might say. Foreshadowing. That's called foreshadowing, ladies and gentlemen.
Classic callback.
We planned it all along.
I guess like bones didn't really ever like quite intrigue me as much as glass. And glass sponges are amazing. If anybody ever wants to look them up, they're cool.
Sponges are really weird. Like in general, really weird. But probably not as weird as like someone's just favorite animal being a glass sponge. Like that's not, you know, like it's just not something that comes up at a bar where someone's like, oh, what's your favorite animal? Oh, I really like elephants because they're so peaceful. I like glass sponges because they entrap lovers. It's just like,
that, yeah.
Okay. You just like slowly back away from this woman.
I feel like this is like a weird personality test where you're just like, alarm bells ringing.
Well, sorry, just throw you under the bus.
It's okay. I brought it on myself. It's okay.
Well, that actually brings us to a very nice question, which is, why are skeletons like they are? How did we get to this point? What's the origin of skeletons? What do we know about how skeletons came to be?
That's a great question.
Thank you.
So, the leading theory basically is way, 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 way back in time. So we're talking like early Silurian. So that's 480-ish, 500 million years ago, long damn time ago, where vertebrates were basically only these little armored fish being the loosest of terms here, because they're basically armored vertebrates. It's this thing, a long tube with a shell on it. It looks closer to a beetle than it does to anything that we would consider a vertebrate today. And there are just a bunch of mudslurpers at the time because jaws hadn't evolved yet. So I think I painted you a picture of these armored little things. There were sponges around too, Emma, don't worry. Sponges were around at the time and they were just sitting there slurping mud. It was cool. And then we think, okay, well, before them, there was something similar to vertebrate, or was a vertebrate, depending on who you ask, but wasn't armored. So why did the armor evolve in the first place? Because the very first bone wasn't on the inside, but actually on the outside. Mm-hmm. So the leading theory is it's actually because of giant sea scorpions, which I think is the most badass reason to evolve bone ever. Wow. So Silurian Eurypterids, these giant sea scorpions, ridiculous claws and a whip pointy tail, basically were hunting and prowling in these shallow seas trying to eat something squishy and delicious. And our vertebrate ancestors just didn't want to be that squishy and delicious thing. And that's where like external armor evolved. And for some reason, some evolutionary reason, bone and dentine, the stuff that makes up your teeth, were the primary components, the primary tissues that actually made up that shell.
Can I ask a quick aside?
Go for it.
What is bone? What is it? Like, how do you define a bone as comparison to, say, a tooth or something else like that?
It's a really good question. So it's partially the chemistry, which I will not really get into, but it's also, so bone, what makes bone very special is that it's a combination of organic and inorganic matrix, basically. It's a bunch of collagen, the stuff that makes our skin stretchy, the stuff that makes our cartilage movable, stuff that makes a bunch of our proteins. Collagen matrix that kind of comes and crisscrosses together, and then a certain mineral infills the inside, and it's calcium and phosphate, and it fills the inside. And that's kind of the basics of bone. If you ask a doctor today, they would tell you bone is also made up of osteocytes, osteoclasts, osteoblasts, and all the cells that make it, because bone is a living tissue. It's not just like our teeth, which are usually pretty much dead on maturity. Like your enamel, once it's made, it's kind of just a mineral crystal structure, no cells, no healing, nothing. Dentine's a little bit different, but bone is this living lattice, this amazing like reactive material because of its cellular components. That's what a doctor would tell you today. However, when you look at these like early mud slurping fish, a lot of them didn't have cells in their bone. So you're like, well, then is it even bone? Then is it even bone as we know it? And so you get into this kind of circular problem where so many of the tissues we define today based on animals that exist today, rather than actually defining it based on animals that first invented it. So it's kind of like looking at a tree and saying, oh yeah, trees are all branches, because you're only looking at the very tip of the branches. You're defining something based on the, you know, very pruned tips of it, rather than its root structure and its like actual trunk. So it's a little bit circular, but bone itself is at the very like basics is collagen, calcium, and phosphate.
Amazing. That was, thank you very much. Yeah. You can, yeah, my aside is finished.
I like the idea of teeth being dead on maturity, and I think dead on maturity is a great name for a rock band.
Yes.
I feel like we should get t-shirts printed to say dead on maturity.
And it should just be a bunch of skeletons dancing, right? Or no, a bunch of teeth people. Like little tooth people.
Yeah.
Like something creepy from a dentist's. Mm. They always have the kind of cartoon teeth.
Yeah.
I feel like Yara and the Mud Slurpers is a really good band name as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have an issue with that. I don't like it.
Well, I'll take it back. It's mine. Mm. I'm keeping it.
Use like mud slurpers is like a derogatory term for these like jawless fish. Like they deserve that. They were down there. They were just like, they were just weird. I'm mad at them personally because they're such a confusing group. Like I hope everyone at home understands that I'm just upset because they confuse me, like in research wise, because people have been researching them for like 150 years. So I had to catch up on 150 years of really old literature, and I'm just upset. It's not their fault. It's my problem.
That's very fair.
I mean, yeah. I mean, to be honest as well, like you could use it as a derogatory term for any number of animal groups. Like someone who works on polychaete worms, oh, you just work on mud slurpers.
Yeah, yeah. If you reduce any animal to like just the way it eats the thing it eats, like I think it just doesn't sound right.
Yeah, like obviously people who are listening to the podcast can't see us, but basically when it went silent, then everyone did that thing where they started looking upwards, like
But just think about it, oh, you cud chewer, like that doesn't sound good.
Yeah.
no cows.
I was thinking of flamingos, you shrimp slurper.
They eat algae, don't
shrimp
they?
Shrimp sliver. No, they eat little shrimp. That's how they get their pink color.
I thought that was from the algae. I don't know. I don't know nothing about flamingos. They're too derived. I was well, obviously flies regurgitate. They vomit on their own food. But isn't it sea urchins that like vomit their entire guts onto the food?
A lot of things vomit their guts on their food.
Yeah.
Starfish too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they're starfish and sea cucumbers are like one's just a fancy version of the other.
Anyway, back to
hostility here.
Yeah, just a lot of mud slurping, basically. Oh, man. Oh, sorry. Someone in the chat has already corrected us. Apparently the shrimps eat the algae and then the flamingos eat the shrimps. That's where they get the colour from. Thank you, chat. Appreciate it. What was my question? I was thinking about shrimps now. Oh, God, this is so professional. That's right. So building blocks. We've got the basic building blocks to make bones. How do teeth become dead on maturity? How does it become a tooth? What's that? What's happening?
Okay, so it kind of, so first of all, teeth are made by a completely different cell group called odontoblasts versus osteoblasts, kind of osteoblast bone building, odontoblast dentin building. And dentin is not exactly dead on maturity, but it's, so the way that the cell builds the dentin is you have all these little cells and they're being neighbors, and they excrete the dentin and move downwards, and they live in your pulp cavity, which is why your pulp cavity is alive, which is why your root canals hurt, which is why if you get a cavity, it hurts. But the dentin itself is only sensitive because those cells, as they move through your tooth, as they're making this wall around themselves, they leave little tubules. And if you ever see like a, I don't know if you guys have Sensodyne, but like, you know, those sensitivity tooth pastes, they show you those tubules and they want to fill those tubules. That's what they're doing. They fill those tubules so that cold doesn't get into them and you don't sense cold and you don't get that sensitivity. So that's kind of how that works. So dentin is semi-dead, wherein it does have connection to a living pulp cavity, but the tissue itself that's excreted is actually not alive anymore. And kind of similarly, your enamel is made by a third cell group called ameloblasts, which are your enamel making cells. And they basically deposit enamel downwards and then they die and then they just disappear. So you don't have them anywhere. So that's why, like, as we eat acidic food, it eats away at our enamel and then it can get to your dentin, and that's how you get sensitivity, that's how you get staining. It's actually your dentin that changes color, not your enamel. So it's made of a bunch of different tissues, and those are actually some of the, like, so cartilage, dentin, enamel, and bone were pretty much all present right at the beginning of vertebrates. Enamel in a more primitive form called enameloid, but basically it was there, and all of them were there at the beginning. So imagine you have the same toolbox from the Silurian and you're just like fiddling with it all the way up and giving us all the different forms, all the different skeletons, all the different insane teeth. Everything is all from the same like pack of building blocks, which to me is like the most amazing thing. Does that answer your question?
There was far more philosophy on that than I was expecting. That's how I like, you know, how old this process is.
Sorry?
The process is just so old that you take it for granted that this is just something we do every day.
Yeah.
Actually, it's like 400 million years in the making.
It's got a lot to answer for, because cephalopods were doing pretty great before we turned up, just saying. So we've got a lot to answer for, these bloody teeth.
I swear we've mentioned more animals that don't have bones than actual animals that have bones.
I mean, that's kind of cool, because people study, I mean, including me, I look at animals that don't have bone to understand why the heck would you even evolve bone in the first place, right? So like, for example, cartilage, which is a precursor for our internal bones, our endochondral bones, so like your long bones, when you're a baby, most of them make like a cartilaginous stencil, basically, and then that infills with bone. And so people try to study the relationship between cartilage and bone really early on. So for example, babies have like way more bones than adults do, almost 100 more, but they don't, like, they do because they're not fused, but they eventually come together, and then that's how we reduce bones. We don't just like drop them out of our body as we grow up. But what's really cool is a lot of invertebrates also have cartilage. So people think, you know, well, maybe we got our cartilage from like our more invertebrate-like ancestors. So it's worth talking about non-bony creatures is what I'm trying to get at here.
Yeah, Emma.
On a vaguely similar topic, things like mollusks, shells, snails, bivalves, things with hard shells, obviously semi-similar to bone, but not really at all.
They use the same building blocks, don't they? Like the same mineral components. Sometimes.
Well, So they almost never use calcium phosphate, right? They almost always use calcium carbonate.
Yeah, that's true, I suppose. And that's, I guess, because of seawater chemistry. It's much easier to get calcium carbonate out of the seawater than it is phosphate. And also phosphate tends to dissolve, kind of.
You don't want your stuff dissolving.
Yeah, can you imagine? Oh.
Well, let me just toot Bone's horn here for us. That sounds wrong. We're going to move.
Wow.
So it happens all the time. All my presentations just like take a bad turn. So bone actually will lower its pH on purpose to release phosphate and calcium into the bloodstream. And they just do that by pumping ions and just lowering the pH in your like cell spaces and in your bones. So I assume that would be really bad for bivalves and gastropods and things with shells, right? Like as soon as you have a little bit of ocean acidification and you're like, oh, I'm melting, goodbye. Like yeah. it's not the look. It's not what they're going for.
It's not what you want, really, in your day-to-day.
Well, I think then my next question is, I'm interested in how do you actually look at these fossils? Like, what is it that you actually do with them? And what kind of equipment do you use to do the kind of work that you're doing?
So originally, a lot of I relied heavily on a method called histology and basically, or paleohistology. So histology is the study of tissues. And so if you go to a doctor and they take a biopsy, they will do histology. Paleohistology is, as you can imagine, the study of ancient tissues. And the way I used to do that, or still do, but to a lesser extent, is I make thin sections. I destroy fossils for a living. So I take a fossil, I embed it in plastic, and I cut it till it's thin enough, grind it till it's thin enough till I can shine light through it. And then you can basically see the microstructure of where the cells used to be, how the bone grew. Same thing with teeth. You can see the lines as the dentine is growing downwards. And that's how I would study tissues. However, new methods like scanning with micro CT and basically just really strong x-rays have kind of changed the field a little bit, because now you can study really small stuff on a bigger scale. I also developed a new method earlier last year, which is called FIB-SEM, or we applied a relatively new method to paleontology. And it's basically like histology and scanning put together. So they're slicing the bone at the cellular level and imaging it at the same time. And then from that, I make like a 3D model and try to understand how cells talk to each other, even though the cell is not there. Basically like how these caves that the cells used to live in are connected. So histology, normal micro CT, and then our new method of FIB-SEM.
I was going to say, this new method that you talked about has one of my favorite science-y stories associated with it, because you did an amazing tweet thread when it came out. And it's that kind of cross-disciplinary science. It's always one of those things that like you read about or you hear about in these kind of SciComm stories, and you're like, oh, cool, that single thought that like sparked like a whole new thing to look at. So I just for the audience, would you mind
giving them
a little background on that? Because I thought it was just way cool when I saw your tweet thread about it.
So long story short, basically my PhD was supposed to be on bone cells in the fossil record, but histology just wasn't cutting it for me at this point, because my equipment was kind of old, and yeah, basically cells are connected in a 3D space, and it's kind of hard to learn something in 3D space from a 2D structure. So I kind of reached the point where I'm like, well, I guess this is something that, you know, the next generation is going to figure out. It's not for me. It's not going to happen in my thesis. Boo-hoo. Let's move on. And as I was reaching that like wall, I visited some co-authors for a different paper, our collaborators, and I went to their workplace here in Berlin, and they are material scientists. And I was walking through their hallway, and they do some scanning for us. And so I was walking through their hallway, and I see this poster, and it looks like they already imaged some bone cells. And I like had a heart attack. I was like, did they already do this research without me? Like, did someone already steal my work? What is going on? And I grab one of them physically, just like, what is this? And they're like, oh yeah, that's FIB-SEM. We do that to like scan batteries all the time to look for pores in batteries. And I'm just like, why does nobody tell me anything? Like, what? Like, nobody tells me anything. I just got mad. My first reaction to most things is just being upset. So I asked them, you know, okay, what do you need to do to, like, can we apply this to fossils? What do you need? They're like, oh, we need a non-volatile structure so it doesn't blow up in our machine. We need something that doesn't change as it's being heated, because they use a gallium ion beam to cut the sample, whatever the sample might be. So you need something that's not frozen or soft tissue or whatever. I'm like, you know what sounds great? Rock. You know what's really rock? You know what fossils are? Basically rock. Let's do this. And that's what we did. And it was insane. And basically nobody had used that method as an imaging method before. People had used it for chemical analysis. So you could vaporize part of your fossil and actually figure out what isotopes are in there. And they've used it for that. But nobody had done serial sectioning and, like, actually tried to image basically cell spaces or any microstructure using this method. And that's why it was such a cool paper and an insane, like, serendipitous moment that it came at that moment that I was like, okay, I'm giving up, bye. And yeah, that poster, people, put up your posters. Like, that's, if you're going to take away anything from this, like, put up your project posters. It might save something. It might save lives.
Amazing. Yeah, it's just like, it's one of those, I heard about it and I was just like, it's just one of those real rare things that just, you know, you're right. It just feels like a serendipitous moment of, like, everything falls into place and you're like, oh, this is perfect. Like, taking something from another field, using it in an entirely novel way, just really, really exciting. It's like the best way that science happens, I think.
Absolutely. And I kind of use this to always argue, like, against separating departments. So we're rebuilding, the museum here has been lucky enough to get a big endowment for a big renewal project, and they want to, you know, rebuild the science campus. And so one of the thoughts that's been going around is, okay, well, we'll put the biologists here and this here and that there. And one of the things that I, like, did say is, because, you know, mix us up. Like, first of all, we all don't like each other that much anyway. Second of all, like, this is what interdisciplinary work comes from. Like, you get to see someone's weird presentation. You accidentally sit beside a physicist because nobody wants to sit beside physicists, but then you learn something. So, like, it actually helps if we're in the same building.
What you're saying to me is that you need glass sponges big enough for paleontologists and physicists to be locked inside forever. Collaborations. That's what I'm hearing.
You got it. I mean, it's true. I mean, even like now synchrotron scanning is so big in paleo, but you can't really do it without, like, physicists and early on, like, material scientists and, you know, like, imaging scientists. That's all because of that kind of collaboration. And I feel like we could really be improving if we were doing more interdisciplinary stuff. It's not just a buzzword. That's my preaching. I'm sorry, guys. I'm always, like, just devolving into preaching. Like, let's do this. Let's change science.
We're all here for this. This is good. This is, like, this is positive stuff. Yeah, I think there's one other person, Susie Maidman, ended up doing, there was a similar thing where, like, she ended up being partnered with a material scientist. I swear, material scientist is where to go. If you want to have some cutting edge research, go and do that. Did a similar thing, did some imaging and managed to see some, like, red blood cells that they hadn't found in fossils before. And we're like, oh, this is crazy. So yeah, I, like, 100% keep preaching. That's what you should be doing. It works out well.
I basically do it just to keep them working with me. Be like, see, I'm talking about you guys, please.
So we've had lots of good questions in the chat. And I know some people have been waiting for a while for me to ask their questions. One of the questions, I think it was the first question, it's such a good question, I'm going to leave it almost until the end. So bear with us, Synapsid fan, your question is coming. But yeah, we've got some really good questions. So we've talked a little bit about scanning fossils. That was one of the questions. In one of the questions, we had a little bit, a question about lags and what lags are. So I was wondering if you could explain to someone who has no idea what a lag is, what is a lag and why are they important?
So a lag is basically an acronym for a line of arrested growth. And if you've ever seen, if you've ever gone to a museum or seen a cut down tree and you see rings in a tree, basically it's the same in bones. And it basically signifies almost the exact same thing. It signifies the passage of time, specifically one season. So the idea is that when an animal, a wild animal, is, you know, happy in the summer, eating well, spring it's eating well, it's growing more. And in the winter, when it starts to eat less or goes into hibernation, or its metabolism slows down, it grows less. And when it grows less, usually that in the bone, in the cross section of bone, the same way that you'd see it in a tree, the growth is so much slower that the area is denser and actually represents a different color or a different growth method all the way around. And so what paleontologists do, or actually what biologists, even modern biologists do, is you'll cut a bone and you'll count the lags. And usually for an animal that, you know, doesn't remodel its bone too much, meaning, you know, it doesn't like renew its internal structure too much, you can actually count almost its whole life, basically how old is it? And if even if you don't have all the lines, you can kind of attempt to retro calculate how many are missing. So basically it's counting tree rings in an animal and you're trying to figure out how old it is. And all it is a slowdown in growth during the winter. So you're counting how many years or how many winters. It's really quite simple as yeah. So it's lines of arrested growth.
Okay. And the question that they've been asked is, how is the best way to count lags? Do you have to do it by hand, or is there any other way that you can do it?
So that's a good question. So first, I'm going to take your question and take it a step back, which is, how do you even get lags? Which element do you cut? Because you're going to have to cut an element, right? So you're going to have to cut a bone at a cross section, and you want to, for example, say you want to count, like, does this species live longer than this species? Then you probably want to cut the same element in this species as you would in this species. That being said, not all elements grow the same. A rib doesn't grow the same as an arm, as a leg. So the average person will take a femur, your leg bone, your upper thigh bone, and we'll cut it mid-shaft. So that means in the middle of the bone. Sometimes that's not really super possible, like with sauropods, really, really big, dumb sauropods, because the section would be like bigger than your face. So what some people do will take a core. So you'll actually drill through it and you'll take a core and you'll make a section out of the core. I personally don't prefer that because lags are not always a beautiful ring all the way around. They can sometimes shift because your bone doesn't actually grow equally all the way around, depending on what muscles are pushing and pulling on it. And as you grow, certain muscles grow faster than others, so your bone will actually shift. So what you do want is mostly a cross section. So even with big animals, I always recommend doing a full cross section, even if it means you're going to take quarters, kind of like a slice of cake. So now you have your section. How do you count it? You are going to do the labor intensive work of taking good images and counting them. And not only that, please, if you are writing a paper, synapsid lover person, draw the lines you count and show it to somebody. Because sometimes I've had other people send me something and I'll count a different number of lines than they do, because sometimes animals have these faded lags, and they might not be true lags. Maybe it just had a hard summer, maybe it had reproductive strain, you know, like a failed reproduction that was a strain. So they are difficult and they're not foolproof, but almost always, I personally count them by hand. Almost everybody I know counts them by hand, because it's really difficult. And you kind of have to count it under a microscope at first and then take your image and then you recount it again, because animals be difficult.
Brains are hard.
Yeah.
True in many ways.
I mean, in fairness, for me, counting is hard. So yeah, take from that what you will.
The counting tool on Photoshop is great, by the way, guys, because like I just, you can go click, 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 and it counts for you. It's wonderful. I sound like an old person now, but it's true. I do it for cells too, because you just like sit there and you count, because I'm like, I'm not going to keep track of this. I'm just going to click. Like, you know, like bouncers at a club, they just click. They're not actually sick.
As you were talking about lags, I was wondering, I wonder if the pandemic would show up on my bones as like a major lag of where I actually get well for once.
There's also a thing called stress lines. They're different. Oh. At least in...
Let's not discuss that.
No? Okay, we'll not talk about that. I'm not talking about like face lines, I promise. But should I actually tell you what a stress line is? So especially in mammals or fast-growing animals in your like long bones, you can actually see if the a person or an animal went through starvation periods because, so you know, our epiphyses, the ends of our long bones, they close, and they close by like incrementally growing towards each other. That incremental growth takes some time, and if an animal or a person was starved, then you get like these lines that show up in just normal x-ray. So anthropologists use it a lot for like early civilizations, and especially like apparent in kids, and they can see like, oh yeah, this was a bad time for them because like all the kids be starving. Like you can tell with just a simple x-ray. It's really interesting. Bone records everything. Sorry for the difference.
Dark.
Sometimes, yeah. But you also like sponges, so I don't know what you're talking about.
I tried to raise the bar here, but I kind of like landed straight back down in doom and gloom. Everything is dark.
For everyone that's just listening, Tom is very skeptical of what Emma's saying. He's like,
all I can just think about is like how bone grows like a 3D printer prints, but like in my body, and it's just freaking me out right now. It's like Lego. It's like putting extra Lego bricks on the top, and it's just anyway. We'll move out of my head. I'm going to do an Emma Dunn segue special for the last 15 or so minutes, and I would like to talk a little bit about one of my interests that is not, I don't research on it, but it's something that I'm very interested in, which is paleopathology. So when I was a master's student, way back when, I wrote a presentation all about the evidence of disease and illness in dinosaurs, and I titled it Dinosaur, which I was very proud of myself about. But actually, the chat is really interested in paleopathology as well, and we've got loads of questions. So one of the good questions is, do we find any evidence of injuries, infections, or evidence of healing in ancient jawless fish armor? And if so, how do they compare to injuries in recent bone? Which is an incredible question.
Who's trying to steal my postdoc? Tell me. No, that's a brilliant question. It really is, because it gets right to the bottom of, did the earliest bone heal the way that we heal today? It really gets right to it. And what I'm going to tell you is, yes, there is a bunch of evidence of healed injuries. Like, we don't know if they're bite marks or not, although there is a paper last year from your group, right, Emma? Maybe? No, sorry, Manchester. It came from a different group. And it showed that a lot of the early jawless fish had more injuries towards the time that jaws actually evolved. But even before that, there were injuries probably from either things like sea scorpions and whatnot. Anyway, so yes, there were injuries. Yes, they did heal. No, they did not heal exactly the same as modern animals do. So there is only one paper that looks at the healing of early jawless fish. And it looks at the healing of early jawless fish in a particular branch of the jawless fish that don't have bone cells. So it's very hard to tell if this is actually representative or if that in itself, this type of healing in itself is a pathology or if it's a specific thing because it's that group. That all being said, that piece of head armor that was clearly punctured or scratched or, you know, whatever, it was damaged, it healed back by filling that hole, not with bone as we would today, but rather with dentin, which is what our teeth are made of, which sounds pretty insane, because imagine you're breaking your arm and you're like, oh look, teeth are growing out of it, it's fine, it does that, it's supposed to do that. Like, that's pretty crazy. Until you realize that actually most armored fish had not just bone that made up their armor, but also they had dentin and enamel on the outside of their armor to make it stronger. So where dentin and enamel actually evolved were as part of that armor structure. They didn't evolve as part of teeth at all. They eventually moved into the mouth cavity to form teeth, and that was later, even after jaws evolved. But initially, they were part of strengthening that outer armor. That being said, why would you heal bone with dentin? And we still don't know. I am looking into some other ones, other jawless fish that don't have dentine, that do have damage, and I'm going to see if they are healing with bone or dentine or something different altogether. But that is to be determined. Stay tuned, etc.
That is a paleo party exclusive right there. Just saying. Yeah. It's what we do. It's what we do.
Such a good question.
Where do we go from that? I don't even know. Wait, but here's a random thing. Sharks' scales are denticles, right? Are they made of dentine? Or am I just completely wrong?
No. They are made of dentine. They're like little teeth. But they're also very different than everything.
Right.
Sharks. Oh, sharks.
Oh, sharks.
Part of my postdoc, hopefully, as well. But so sharks kind of took own path really early because they diverged from everything that made us super early on. We assume that, yes, they came from a group that definitely, you know, got their jaws alongside us. They probably came from the same branch that, you know, had jawed fish as us. But we don't actually even know if they evolved teeth from the same ancestor that we did, or they evolved it separately. We don't know any of that. And their denticles, they're toothy little teeth, they're toothy skin. Like if you pet a shark, it's rough one way and smooth the other. They're weird. They're little teeth that have little enamel bits, they have dentine, and they have a bony base. And they just float in the skin and they help them like glide through water. And they don't replace the same way teeth do. So if a shark gets scratched or part of those little few teeth get pulled out, they eventually like heal the skin like normal skin would heal. And then they regrow brand new teeth or like denticles or little bits into that little groove. And usually they don't look quite right. They serve the purpose, but they just look a little odd. They're usually a little smaller, a little deformed, but yeah. So it's not healing exactly. It's more of like a replacement. It's really odd. Sharks are weird. Oh, sharks. They didn't make it this far for nothing. They've been weird from the beginning.
It's a long time. One of my favorite paleo facts, sharks have been around for longer than plants. So, or land plants, at least.
Well, longer than trees. Yeah. They're crazy.
I was going to take things in a slightly different direction for a minute. I want to know why bone? What got you interested in this? How did you get onto this field? Because it's so different from so many, you know, it's very outside of your normal like paleontology box. Like what led you to being interested in teeth and bones and what's next? Skin? Something else?
Maybe cartilage. Is it really outside of the paleo box? I mean
well, literally every skeleton, we'll gloss over that, Christopher Dean.
Sorry. I don't really do work on bone, except, I mean, some of us just, you know, touch numbers. Just fine. But really, most of paleo is bone. And I guess because my background is... So how I got into paleontology in the first place was I was studying for medical school, and I've always been interested in development and genetics and tissue development and expression. So I've always been interested in that. And then when I discovered histology in my master's, I realized that, holy shit, like you could do this into the millions of years. Like that's insane. You can talk about development in millions of years. And that just kind of broke my brain. And it must be the trauma or something, but I always go towards like what hurts, like what is the most confusing. And so that's what happened. That's what got me into teeth. And then the PhD position here was already available. I didn't actually write the grant, but like they already told me, hey, do you want to work on bone cells? And I'm like, how interesting could bone be? Teeth are so much more interesting. And then as I started to read about it, it broke my brain, and therefore I was instantly interested. So that's how I got into bones.
Fair enough. Very fair. I'm so used to the computers. I'm sorry. I'm so used to sitting there typing up my diversity curves, whatever else. It's such a building block of paleontology, and it's one that I'm always, you know, you think of a bone, but you think of it as a dinosaur or whatever else. I never think of it as an item to be studied in itself. And that to me is kind of, it's kind of fascinating.
I love everybody's "I fell into paleontology" stories, because I also fell into paleontology kind of similarly. I was doing zoology and I was determined to be like a conservationist, ecologist or something. But then I was like, wait, you can add time to this? You can do it in 4D? And that's where I ended up. So
I mean, it's just like one too many wrong turns. And then you're like, I like where I'm at. This is the one. Like,
yeah, it's funny. It's funny that actually you say that, Chris, because like, as someone who works on trying to understand fossilization and the actual process of fossilization, and particularly on how soft tissues can become fossils, like, one of the questions I get asked all the time is, how do dinosaur skeletons form? Like, how do skeletons form? And it's actually like something that we just take for granted, that like rocks turn into bone. Oh my god. Bone turns into... I'll edit that out. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. It's fine. You'll hear like a weird robot voice and it will just say like, how bone turns into rock. It'll be fine. Don't worry about it. So yeah, it's interesting. And I think that's... It's really interesting because, you know, when you think about the, like, the intricacies of what we do, I really like how, like, you guys look at this massive picture. Like, you look at the whole of the fossil record. Like, Emma's work looking at, like, you know, entire groups through time. And I look at this, like, the moments after death, and then Yara's just there just punching holes through bone, like, yeah! I just think it's so cool. Like, we all just do such random things.
The sound effects really made that for me.
Yeah, that was the creme de la creme.
I'll edit them out too, don't worry about it. Oh god, I'm so tired.
whenever someone asks me, hey, what do I have to study to become a paleontologist, I'm like, what are you already studying? Like, what are you already like, oh, you already studying chemistry and you enjoy chemistry, you can use chemistry in paleo. You are studying, like, you know, whatever, like, physics, you can use physics. You are using, like almost anything can be applied in paleo. So, like, we all end up being this amazing amalgamation of, like, some geology trained, some zoology trained, some not even at all, and then we kind of just look at each other in bewilderment and we're like, I have many questions, hi, like, I don't know what you do, but I think you're cool and help me. And at least that's how I start my collaborations. I don't know about you guys.
Unless you ask someone, like, what are you working on, and they say, like, the Bolshevik revolution of 1918, you'd be like, I'm sure we can fit you into paleontology somewhere.
Go work.
Thinking of your background and how you got in here, and going back to paleopathology, do you have a favorite fossil paleopathology? Because I feel like asking you your favorite fossil might not be quite as cool, but do you have a favorite fossil pathology that you've either come across or know about?
Emma, you've kind of scooped us. So, not almost, not quite. Because, right, I would like to hear the answer. I think that's a brilliant question. But Synapsid Fan, the very first question said, Yara, what is the most underappreciated bone of all animals ever? So it's almost the same question. So I'll let you have, you can have your favorite pathology, but also, what's your favorite bone?
What's my favorite bone? That's really weird. Oh, wow. Hold on.
We ask the difficult questions here of paleobody.
That's really difficult. And now I need to know who this is. So my favorite, I'll go to my favorite fossil pathology first. And it's actually already pretty much been answered. It is that earliest healed pathology that heals with dentine, because it makes no sense. Only seconded by anything that's embedded in anything, because there's a bunch of examples of, like, mosasaurs with shark teeth embedded in their jaws, hadrosaurs with teeth in their vertebrae that, like, it just healed over, like, that kind of stuff. To me, absolutely insane. There's also a short-necked plesiosaur in Australia that I've been meaning to visit that just has, like, a massive infection from chest to arm. And the whole thing is just, like, really messed up, but it didn't care. It kept swimming. It survived healing that. It didn't mind. It was just like, I'm just going to keep eating fish. You arm thing, do whatever you're doing.
I'm sure it minded. It was probably like, you know, like when it's just like, ooh, ah, ooh, ah.
Or also the two-headed lizard embryo. Ooh. That's a developmental pathology. And there's a two-headed, turtle embryo that we have as well. Like, all those are so weird. But I think, yeah, the weirdest ones to me are the ones that tell a big evolutionary story. So like the earliest one that heals with dentine, or ones that tell like crazy behavioral stuff, like stomped on tails or weird facial injuries that tell you about, you know, the animals' interactions with each other. Like pathology is such an untapped niche that there's like, there's only basically one person that has a full PhD on it. My PhD has some pathology, but like overall, everyone thought before, they thought it was just like a gee whiz, like one, oh cool, this one animal has this one break, great. But they never looked at like the bigger implications of that. And that's why pathology is cool. Not that I need to tell you guys, I think you're already converted into the
paleontology. Yep.
Now, for the weirdest bone.
It doesn't have to be weirdest, it could just be your favorite. The actual question was, what's the most underappreciated bone?
So hard. I like really weird bones that nobody know exist. So I'm gonna talk about the it's a tie. It's a tie between the os cartis, which is the heart bone, and the os clitoris, which is the clitoral bone. So I'm gonna just talk about both. So much like a baculum, which is the penis bone in many mammals, there is actually a clitoral bone in some animals, including bears. Bears, I think, have like a pretty large, like little, it's just like a little ossification. It's really weird. And so I just think it's weird because it's kind of a minor fuck you to everyone. Like there's bones everywhere and some of them don't really have a function because like that one doesn't super have a function, and neither does the one in the heart. So in humans, if you start to develop bones in your heart, it's a pathology, not so great. Other animals do it as just like part of their maturity. It just kind of strengthens. It's a really, really thin sheet of bone that strengthens where their valves are and the wall between the two atria. So it kind of just helps separate the parts as the bone, as the heart works really hard. And it's found in things that are not related. It's found in sheep, it is found in chimps, and it's found in otters. And it's just like, okay, what now? Like, why? And a bunch of bovids. And some people say, no, it's definitely pathological. And then other people are like, we're finding it fully like healthy adults and they're fine. And just the older they get, the bigger this like sheet of bone appears. And I like finding really weird, just random bony bits that don't make any sense. So I don't know if that answered your question, but there's really weird bones everywhere.
I learned so much.
Yeah, that was a great answer.
Yeah, that was amazing.
I actually have quite an interesting story about a friend of mine used to basically not, she didn't work as a taxidermist, but she used to help at a taxidermist where they would stuff people's pet dogs. And they would also skeletonize dogs for people. And they would have a moral question about whether the person who had brought their dog in to be skeletonized was the sort of person who should have the dog baculum put in place, or whether they should just remove it. And that was like an actual question. They would have to, like, when the person came in, they wouldn't ask them. They'd just weigh up whether or not they were the sort of person who looked like they might be upset by a baculum.
That's pretty ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, it's funny, but I have a friend who's a groomer. Who like I've had, she's told me that she's had people like specifically tell her to like not trim up the dog's like stomach too much because he didn't want to explain to his daughter like what was going on down there. And I'm like, imagine you show that person a baculum, they're gonna be just so confused.
Yeah. Show them like a walrus baculum, they're like 30 odd centimeters long. Jeez Louise. The person who asked the question, by the way, in chat, Synapsid Fan, said exactly the kind of answer I was hoping for, and I now know about two bones I'd never heard of before. So, public service announcement done.
Yeah, I've done my job.
Someone in the chat has just said, I'm very curious about the type of person they decided that said, yep, they look like they want a baculum. Yeah, I know. Well, yeah.
So true.
What's the criteria?
I don't know.
Look like a baculum person, I can just tell.
Yeah.
Gonora.
Maybe for future Paleo Party merch, we should have a t-shirt that just says, you look like the sort of person who would enjoy a baculum. Well, on that bombshell, I think this is probably quite a good place to leave today's episode. So, you know, all good things have to come to an end. We will be back next week for the last of the current season of Paleo Party. And don't forget that you can listen to us anywhere where you can download podcasts. Our website will be up to date tomorrow. It's not up to date right now, but it will be up to date tomorrow with upcoming guests. And don't forget that you can follow us on Twitter. And I think we have to say a massive thank you to our guest, Yara. We've laughed a lot today. I've learned a lot. I do not have a bone to pick with anyone. I've used that joke already, so I'll edit that out. But you can follow Yara on Twitter at Yara Herodi. And that's it. So it's goodbye from us, and we'll see you next week. So take care, everyone. Bye.
Bye.